You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Overdose deaths that are linked to heroin have risen dramatically in the last few years, jumping 39% from 2012 to 2013. There are some promising treatments, including the drug Suboxone, which the medical establishment views as the best hope for addicts. But unfortunately, in their year-long investigation into how heroin substance abuse programs are failing addicts in Kentucky, Ryan Grimm and Jason Cherkis learned that of the dozens of publicly funded treatment facilities throughout Kentucky, only a couple offer the drug. Their article, Dying to Be Free, There's a Treatment for Heroin Addiction That Actually Works, Why Aren't We Using It?, is published in the Huffington Post, and I'm very pleased it has brought them to our show today. Hello.
Hey, hello.
Now, Ryan, does Kentucky have higher addiction rates to heroin than other states, or could you have found similar situations elsewhere?
It has higher rates, but that's largely because it's an extremely rural state, and rural states that had an opiate crisis over the last decade are the places where heroin has hit the hardest. But we easily could have gone to Vermont, or we could have gone anywhere else in the South. We could have gone to Maine. We could have gone to the Midwest and a lot of places in the West. The problem is not insignificant in cities, but in rural areas is where it seems to be hitting the hardest.
And you say especially in places that where there's a chronic lack of access to health care, like Appalachia, where from the 1990s on, Percocet, OxyContin, and Opana became commonplace.
So people
are self-medicating?
That's right. So people are now self-treating with drugs like Suboxone when they can't get access to them. But over the last decade to 15 years, you had a bit of a reform within the medical community where they made a push to try to make people pain-free. They said, you know, we're tolerating higher levels of pain than we ought to be. The pharmaceutical industry came in behind that and made a lot of claims about the value and lack of addictiveness of drugs like OxyContin, which eventually you saw things get somewhat out of hand, especially in places like Kentucky, where there's so little economic opportunity. All of a sudden, you could get a prescription or for a bottle of pills for just your copay, and you could sell each one of these pills for, you know, somewhere between $10 and $50 each, and for somebody, you know, who's making just a couple hundred dollars a month, you know, that's kind of an irresistible thing, and so you saw a spread of illicit drug use. You saw people get hooked. They then came down and crushed a lot of these so-called pill mills at the same time that heroin imports were increasing. Heroin purity was increasing. The price was dropping, and so people switched from the more pricey pills to the cheaper heroin.
And where's the heroin coming from?
It's coming mostly from Mexico. You have an interesting development in the sense that the cartels are moving away from shipping cocaine into the United States and instead moving it over into Europe. We talked to one source who's closely involved with this, and he said you can get $45,000 in Amsterdam for a kilo of cocaine, whereas New York City is going to fetch something more like $7,500. So the consequence is that the cartels are shipping cocaine over to Europe, and instead of cocaine, they're moving a lot of heroin into the United States. It's something that can be easily grown in Mexico or anywhere else. Poppies, you can grow poppies up and down the East Coast, in fact, or West Coast, anywhere in America. You could pretty much grow them in your garden.
And then, of course, it's coming from Afghanistan and elsewhere.
The number of acres in cultivation in Afghanistan surged since the U.S. intervention there, and so that's really feeding a lot of the European appetite, which then frees up the Mexican heroin to kind of move into the United States. That's absolutely right.
Jason, you quote officials like Kevin Sabat, a former senior drug policy official in the Obama administration, who told you, "We always were concerned about heroin. We were always cognizant of the push-down, pop-up problem." What does push-down, pop-up mean?
I think what he's referring to is that they knew that if they had cracked down on the illicit pill trade, that they would create, by pushing down on the pill trade, that they would create a problem where heroin could spike up. And I think that that was the kind of consensus that we had gotten both from federal officials. I had talked to an official from the federal agency that oversees drug treatment. They were aware of the issue that if they had cracked down on pills, they were going to create a heroin problem. And the same in Kentucky. They had enacted legislation a few years ago to crack down on pill mills and to rein in doctors. And they also knew that a heroin problem could be and potentially a likely outcome. They just didn't realize how big of a demand there was for heroin, and that how easy it was for folks who were using pills, were addicted to pills, how easily they could switch to heroin, because they're essentially, they have the same properties, and you could just as easily crush heroin and snort it. A lot of people sort of started by snorting heroin and then moving into IV use.
He said crooks are putting on white coats and handing out pills like candy. Is he saying that doctors have become corrupt?
I think he was referring to the pill mills and through, and in those cases where you would have doctors who would write, pretty blatantly, wrong prescriptions for different pills, to individuals for, say, a prescription for like 50 pills, 100 pills, for a different pain medication. I think he was referring to these sort of unscrupulous doctors that were just using the pain industry, the pills like Oxycontin or Opana, Lortab, they were turning them into illicit drugs.
Now, Ryan, the article begins with the image of a young man, Patrick Cagey, walking out of a 30-day drug treatment facility in Georgetown, Kentucky. How did he get there in the first place?
His parents called around for places that that had an opening. It's a familiar drama that parents go through when their teen or adult child comes to them and tells them that they have a problem. You instantly want to do everything that you can. You're willing to drain your bank account. You're willing to do whatever you can to try to beat this disease, and you start just dialing treatment center after treatment center. And what you're typically told is that there's a waiting list, or that they do not do what's called detox, and so the person would have to be relatively clean when they show up for treatment. So what parents do is they just call and call and call until they win the lottery and they find a bed in one of these treatment centers, which as we found may not end up being as fortunate in the end as they had thought it was when they first landed their child there.
Now, Patrick seems like an unlikely person to be a heroin addict. You have a picture of him exiting the program because his father was proud of him and his success reminded him of when he graduated from college.
Right. Our picture of a heroin addict is some skinny and scraggly person who's pockmarked and shows signs of years of abuse. Patrick was he was a bodybuilder. He was he was someone who he took great care of himself, as we mentioned in the story. When he was wrestling, he would measure his water intake down to the ounce. This was an extremely disciplined person, and even at the end of his addiction and the end of his life, he did not look anything like the stereotype of the heroin addict. And this is something that you find all across the country and all across Kentucky when you actually see pictures of people and hear the stories of the people who overdosed. None of them end up matching what you think is the stereotype of a heroin addict. This is something new.
Tell us about his job after he left college.
Well, I think he started, he had a series of jobs. He was, I think, a fitness instructor, a fitness trainer, and then he later took a job as working for, as an assistant, as a person that helps people who are suffering from traumatic brain injury. He would go to their houses. He would help them, you know, with everyday tasks and help them sort of get back on their feet. It was a job that I think might have been, I think he probably considered his first real job, the first job that gave him a sense of pride, a sense of satisfaction. And when he was fired from that job for, I think, linked to his heroin habit, it was devastating to him. I think that that's something that he had talked about both at treatment and with his parents. I think it was a real eye-opener for him that there were real consequences to his using. It was definitely something that he had thought about after treatment, at least, you know, obviously briefly. He had discussed this with his parents, this idea of maybe going to graduate school to sort of further his studies, maybe go into graduate school for physical therapy or something related to helping a traumatic brain injury victim.
Now, his parents were rather sophisticated in this area. In fact, his mother had worked in a methadone clinic. How did he wind up being addicted to heroin? I know he started taking prescription opioids to treat a knee injury, but then there's a big jump from that to becoming a heroin addict.
I think what's interesting is that among pill folks who had gone in through or became addicted to pills, there really wasn't that much of a jump. I had interviewed dozens and dozens of addicts and parents, and the sense that I got was the transition was an easy one. And you know, I talked to some police officers as well, and they really felt like, you know, there was a generation that skipped all the lessons related to heroin, that for a generation of kids, they didn't talk about heroin. They didn't get the message that heroin was so deadly. And so when the pills sort of dried up and heroin was available and you can snort it, there really wasn't a lot of hesitation on the part of addicts. And I think Patrick didn't hesitate because he had been so in the grip of his opiate addiction. It was an easy transition. Unfortunately, it was a quick transition. And it was a transition that has consequences. I mean, but also keep in mind that when somebody has a pill addiction, those can be and are very, very deadly. And we still have thousands, over 10,000 people every year, close to 17,000 people die every year of overdosing on painkillers. So the medications that he was taking, the Oxycontins and the Percocets, you can overdose on those quite easily.
Now he decided to go into rehab after he lost his job.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happens when you go to rehab these days? Do they give you methadone or Suboxone? And what's the difference? Methadone always was a controversial treatment. Is it not as good as Suboxone?
I mean, I think it really depends on the individual, depending on the severity of their addiction. I think studies have shown that perhaps methadone might work best for somebody with a more severe addiction, who's sort of been an addict for, you know, maybe a decade or more, or where the addiction really has taken a super firm grip. I think with Suboxone, it may work for somebody like Patrick, who was younger, had used maybe for a couple of years. I know he had been a heroin addict for just a year. And I think it kind of depends. In a perfect world, it would be a decision made by a doctor between a doctor and a patient, talking through the various treatments and the various options. I think that when you step into a treatment center these days, it is largely devoid of any sort of medical interventions. It's largely cut off from doctors or any kind of, you know, medical treatments related to these kinds of addictions. And so what you end up getting is an abstinence-based or a 12-step approach and not a medical model. You certainly don't get choice. That's one of the main issues. You don't get a choice.
We're going to take a little break, and we'll come back and talk about abstinence and 12-step programs and the like. My guests are Jason Cherkis, national investigative reporter for the Huffington Post, previously worked as a crime reporter for 14 years at the Washington City paper, and Ryan Grimm, Washington bureau chief for the Huffington Post and an MSNBC contributor. We are talking about an article they co-wrote called Dying to Be Free. There's a treatment for heroin addiction that actually works. Why aren't we using it? It's published in the Huffington Post, and we have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. We've also included photos and videos that are part of the report. We are back with Ryan Grimm and Jason Cherkis of the Huffington Post. Their article, Dying to Be Free, There's a Treatment for Heroin Addiction That Actually Works, Why Aren't We Using It? We have a link to that on our show page at WNYC.org. Hadn't Patrick tried Suboxone when he couldn't get heroin? It didn't work for him. So these drugs aren't 100% effective, despite what you say in your headline here?
Nothing is 100% effective, but for Patrick, it did work for the purposes that he was using it for. What a lot of people will do on the black market, if they can't find heroin and they're going through withdrawal, they'll look for something that will take away the pain of that withdrawal. The majority of people who use Suboxone on the black market, however, are doing what's called self-treating. They're trying to kick their heroin habit, that they don't have the $31,500 it costs for an average stay at a 30-day center. And so they're trying to do it on their own by buying Suboxone, which is well known within the addiction community to be a substitute treatment for heroin.
Now, a listener called in to bring up ayahuasca, which is used, he says, by many clinics. It's African in origin and used in South American clinics, Brazil and Mexico, and wonders if either of you have heard of it.
Yeah, so ayahuasca and ibogaine are both kind of well known within certain communities within the treatment community. It's nothing that the CDC would comment on. These are very, very powerful hallucinogens that send you into a deep kind of psychedelic state for between 12 or 72 hours, and people who come out of it will testify that as a result of that they've been able to come out of their addiction. One thing to remember is that if you're going pure cold turkey, even after you've come out of ayahuasca or an ibogaine experience, and you feel like you've kicked your habit, you still may end up having a lot of cravings. And if you feed that craving, now your tolerance is much diminished from what it used to be, and the same narcotic dose that you were taking when you're an addict, you take now, can wind up being fatal. But if you can Google ibogaine or ayahuasca and heroin treatment and find all sorts of anecdotal stories about it.
Now, in Kentucky, isn't there resistance to using any drug medical assistance in addiction recovery?
Yeah, I found that to be widespread in terms of the resistance to this, both among treatment providers and drug court judges. Those are the main sort of folks who would administer any kind of treatment or direct treatment.
So they say abstinence alone is the best approach?
They would say that abstinence alone, or in concert with a 12-step approach like an NA or AA, oftentimes, even in Kentucky, this is court policy that if you're even taking Suboxone or methadone, you're in a program and you're a defendant, and you want to go through a drug diversion program, you don't want to go to jail or prison, you would have to taper off these medications and then go into an abstinence-based program.
Do we know what the success rates of recovering heroin addicts are from abstinence alone?
Well, I think, the sort of safe answer would be not many. I think, by and large, 90%, the going numbers are around 90% of opiate or heroin addicts that go through an abstinence-based treatment will end up relapsing within a year.
What's the theory behind the 30-day treatment programs? Is that really enough time to kick a habit, restructure one's life, and return to a normal life?
That's something that I was pretty fascinated about, because there is this sort of prevalence of the so-called 30-day wonder, where you go into a place and you get 28 days, partially it's detox, and then you go into some sort of group therapy or programming. I found that's something that I wanted to sort of ask doctors about, or people that study the brain chemistry of addicts, and they had said, you know, by and large, that an addict's brain is not healed, is not righted within 30 days, not even close, and that they will come out of this facility, these places, after 30 days, still with a brain chemistry that is largely still hooked to the drug, to heroin, that these triggers, such as driving past an old place where he used to buy heroin, or maybe a certain smell, hearing a war story from another addict, could be potential triggers for relapse. And I'd seen that many times since I'd been on the story so long, I'd seen it many times take place among addicts where some of the ones that I were sort of chronicling in my reporting had relapsed while I was doing the reporting. And they described the relapse as just this moment of unthinkingness where the brain just sort of took over, where the trigger hit them so hard they couldn't even really make a decision. They just decided to use heroin.
Aren't Narcotics Anonymous meetings considered a potentially dangerous place, since they're full of people who are struggling to get free of their addictions?
That was a common complaint. I think even Patrick, he was only out of treatment for 4 days before he died. He had sort of talked a little bit about that some of the folks in NA he did not think were very credible or could be problems for him. And that was something that I had heard from other addicts, that, you know, just hearing the other stories from other addicts could be triggers for them, that it made them want to use again, or that they were mixing with people that were already using or were, they could buy outside of an NA meeting,
right,
be an issue.
Yeah,
a lot of heroin addicts would go to AA, too. They thought that AA might be safer for them in a way.
But in both cases, we're talking about abstinence programs.
Yeah.
And as you point out, Patrick died not long after he was released of an overdose?
He died 4 days later after leaving drug treatment, and he died of an overdose.
My guests are Ryan Grimm and Jason Cherkis. Their article, Dying to Be Free, There's a Treatment for Heroin Addiction That Actually Works, Why Aren't We Using It?, has been published by the Huffington Post, where they both work. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You write that in Cincinnati, an entry point for heroin heading to Kentucky, the street dealers beckoning from corners call it dog or pup or dog food. Sometimes they even advertise their product by barking at you. Don't government officials, don't cops hear them barking?
You know, I think a lot of the kids just didn't have any fear. They didn't fear the police picking them up, and they thought that the police were kind of a minor annoyance, if nobody feared the police.
It sounds like The Wire.
It does. And there was a great story that we didn't put in the piece just because it wasn't really that relevant, but there was a guy, an addict, who had told me that there was a dealer who had set up outside of the probation office in Cincinnati, and he had was selling puppies, literally dogs. He had a little kennel, and he had stopped by to check out the dogs just because it was so weird, and the guy offered him dog, you know, heroin. He said, "Do you want to buy heroin?" And he, I don't remember whether he used that day or not, but he just thought it was so crazy that this guy was so confident that he could, you know, not only sell puppies, like real dogs, but also dog in front of the right next to the police, right next to law enforcement.
Ohio recorded 680 heroin overdose deaths in 2012, up 60% over the previous year, with one public health advocate telling a local newspaper that Cincinnati and its suburbs suffered a fatal overdose every other day. Southern Ohio is next to Kentucky, so obviously this sort of thing knows no state boundaries.
Sure, yeah. Kentucky, I think a lot of people on the East Coast don't realize Kentucky is just across the board. border. It, you know, the you know, a lot of Kentucky suburbs are suburbs of Cincinnati, but certainly the drug moves quite quickly, you know, around the country. No question about it.
It's obviously getting worse. You write, this past December alone, five emergency rooms in northern Kentucky saved 123 heroin overdose patients. Those ERs saw at least 745 such cases in 2014, 200 more than the previous year. So this is an epidemic, and is it being seen as such by officials in Kentucky, or has Kentucky politics, which also has gotten very involved with trying to come up with some kind of compromise with Obamacare, been playing a role in all of this?
Yeah, it's so severe, particularly in Kentucky, that that it is a subject that the state legislature deals with, and that it makes the news. The sheer numbers are just awesome in Kentucky, and they are inspiring at least some conversation. The problem is that the way that you could treat this epidemic runs counter to the way that Kentucky and the rest of America has viewed drug use for the last 100 years plus. You know, it's viewed through the prism of morality and politics, and whenever a bill starts moving through the Kentucky legislature, you quickly have people who say these are addicts. This is their fault. Why are we doing anything to help them? They ought to be helping themselves. And the idea that you would give them a semi-synthetic opioid in order to substitute for their heroin addiction just blows the minds of legislators who think that the only appropriate response is that everyone be 100% clean and sober, and if they're not, then it's their fault.
And Rand Paul created quite a stir by saying that he doesn't think that people should be forced to have vaccinations for the measles. So this would be all part of a kind of a libertarian sensibility?
Well, it's more an evangelical kind of theological approach to it. And in fact, Rand Paul, because of his libertarian sentiment, is actually much more open to other avenues of treating drug addiction. You know, he believes that the drug war has been a complete failure, and a different approach needs to be taken. He would not be the kind of politician who would say that you need to restrict the relationship between patients and their doctors here. He would be close. While it might be noxious on the vaccine side, he would say that the addict ought to have the choice of all of the different treatments that are available, rather than being force-fed abstinence only.
In the last part of your article, you follow Patrick's parents to the recovery program because they wanted his file. What were they hoping to find, and what did they find?
I think what they were wanting to find is just throughout Patrick's time in drug treatment, they were constantly told that Patrick was doing fine. They would ask the social worker, the therapist, whoever was sort of their person that they would call, and they would give the same answer, Patrick is doing fine. And then when Patrick came home and he passed away so soon after drug treatment, I think they were looking for answers as to, like, what actually went on there. Were there clues in his file? What did they overlook? What did the treatment center overlook? How did he really do? And I think that they were concerned. I think that's what they wanted. They wanted answers to that. What happened the last month of his life? At bottom, that's what they wanted. And you were going to say something? I'm sorry.
No, finish your point.
And what they found was that they have a really hard time reading those records. It's very difficult and very painful for them to go through them because he's revealing things about himself that are painful. And also the realization that the center that they placed him in was so lackadaisical in a way, or so non-medical. They just did not provide the level of care that they had imagined that they were getting. There was like a week or 2 weeks from his death, and he's watching a movie, and they're calling it cinema therapy. there really is, if you take doctors out of the equation, if you take a medical approach out of the equation, there really isn't a lot that can be done in the drug treatment besides group therapy or counseling. And, you know, even the therapist that he was assigned was just basically telling him about the rules of the facility over and over again. What they found, instead of care, they found a real lack of care at the facility.
A listener called in to say that to use Suboxone, people have to be in withdrawal. Before Suboxone, there was Subutex, which worked very well, but virtually impossible to get. Most people don't use Suboxone, as they have to be far along to use it. What happened to Subutex, this listener wonders?
Well, Subutex is the generic buprenorphine. I think for a lot of people, especially in the United States, they would prefer to have people use Suboxone because it's a little bit, it's slightly safer, if only for the fact that if you were to dilute your Suboxone and inject it, which is something that people rarely would do, but some people would do it. It's just a sort of a safeguard against that. If you do inject it, the naloxone, it's made with a little bit of naloxone in there, which is the drug that paramedics use to revive overdose victims, so that if you do inject it, you will be put into a mild withdrawal. It's a further protection for those that are going to misuse Suboxone. It's a very marginally safer drug than Subutex, but both are safe.
A caller's son has been in and out of rehab and is about to turn 26. Once he turns 26, he'll have no health benefits. What happens then?
Well, as you know, with Kentucky and their implementation of the ACA, they're hoping, and they've been trying, I know there's been sort of nascent efforts among community groups and community organizers to start linking heroin addicts up to the ACA, to sign them up for Medicaid or for highly subsidized health insurance. And so that's something that this gentleman could try to find.
Now you're
sign up for the Obamacare.
Now your article in Huffington Post includes videos and also it's interactive. You have, I'm assuming, heard from people who have had to deal with this on a personal level. What kinds of things have you been hearing?
We've been hearing from a lot of people who have experience with Suboxone. We heard from some who we also heard from some people whose loved ones had tried an abstinence-based approach and didn't survive. But overwhelmingly, what we're hearing from people is that before they got on Suboxone, they had tried everything, and this is what finally worked for them. We heard from one person who's been on Suboxone for 12 years, which is almost as long as you could have been on it because it was only approved in 2002. A lot of questions, and one of the questions that a lot of people have is, well, what next? Is this something that you're just on forever? Now, most of the people that have written in have said it, they were on it for 2 or 3 years and then once they had kind of stabilized their brain chemistry and stabilized their lives, they were able to taper off of it. But the woman who was on it for 12 years said that she is quite happy to be on it for the rest of her life. She has a husband, she has children, she has her life back together. And what people don't seem to understand is that there is a significant difference between addiction and dependence. Addiction is a dependence that comes with negative consequences. You know it's hurting you and you can or hurting other people and you continue to do it anyway. Dependence is different. A diabetic patient is dependent on insulin. Somebody depressed might be dependent on antidepressants. A recovering addict might be dependent on Suboxone. As long as there are no negative consequences or repercussions from the use of that Suboxone, and you can go on living an ordinary life, then it certainly beats dying of a heroin overdose.
Dying to be free, there's a treatment for heroin addiction that actually works. Why aren't we using it? It's published by the Huffington Post. We have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. My great thanks to Ryan Grimm and Jason Cherkis for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.